Session number 12251, Mr. S. Wood, Reel 7.
Reel 7. Before we leave Burma and the battalion, Mr. Wood, can you tell me, if a man was wounded, what were the arrangements for getting him out?
Well, virtually, when they were wounded, they were picked up obviously by the company's first aid laddies, and the ambulance virtually was a converted Land Rover with four stretchers on, which would bump its way down the track to the nearest base unit. Which varied depending upon how far you were progressing ahead, where there was virtually a marquee, and that was the hospital. And when the doctors operated virtually there, under the same conditions, you know, tough conditions, but that's the only thing.
Was there an MO and small staff with the companies?
There was also, yes, we had Teddy Jones with us there and his medical orderlies, but if, obviously, that was from day to day sort of minor things, but anybody who had severe fever or severe wounds or whatever, they'd be taken back bumping on the old jeep with four stretchers back to the base and in hospital. And obviously if they were too badly wounded, they'd be taken to the nearest place to be flown out of India, or if they were recovered, well, they'd be returned to unit.
Did you yourself suffer anything?
Yes, at one stage this was shortly after having crossed after Palike and Mandalay had been taken. We'd just got bedded down for the night, having wrecked an area where we thought there were some Japs still holding out, and we'd pulled back, and I remember settling down for the night, and I can't remember anything else till I didn't know where I was. I was just bumping up and down, and I thought I was having a nightmare, and I opened my eyes and I could see the leaves passing over me, and I felt, and I was actually on a stretcher, and I found it out later what it was. I was flaked out again with fever and throat infection, and this was about 45 minutes, they said, back behind the lines, an hour possibly, and I woke up in a marquee where I was being treated for this abscesses in the throat and fever and whatever, and all the other wounded laddies there, and I think I was there about a fortnight, and I was rather lucky because when I left there, this was the period when the regiment was about to be flown out of Burma back to for this exercise mentioned previously, where we were going to be sailing down the coast. So I'd only been back about 24 hours from the sick bay virtually when we were being flown out to Chittagong and on back up to Calcutta.
Did you ever find out what it was that caused your fever?
No, there were so many different things. I mean, you know, you got dengue fever, dysentery, malaria of various types. There were so many different things, but all I know is that they cured me and I was fit again as far as they're concerned. And
did you get leave or rest at all during the campaign?
You got rest, but no leave.
What did rest really mean?
Just pulled into reserve and a change of battle gear and relaxation and a bit of extra food, regular food.
What was the postal situation for letters and parcels?
It was better than one could expect under those conditions. Occasionally you'd get none for a while, then a lot would have probably arrived all at once. Two interesting things on a personal note. My mother had actually baked a cake in a tin and had sealed it. It was a circular biscuit tin about a foot across and about 2 inches deep. It was a homemade cake sealed up, and that arrived one night. And if you've ever seen a happy gang sitting round there cutting chunks of cake and eating it, something of that nature after the food we're having. And also there's a friend of mine who had left in India, actually, a lad called Cook. He'd been with another officer and I with the Inniskillings. And he'd been sent back on a most unusual complaint. He couldn't sweat or perspire at all, and we'd finished playing a regimental game, and he was as pink as anything, and he was bone dry, and the MO made him drink about many pints of water and salt and whatever, and they were running up and down the balcony, and they couldn't get him to perspire. Within 48 hours, he was on a plane back to the UK. And to come back to Burma, one of these little parcel arrived one day. It was from Cookie. And there was a little note inside. "You know how to get home? Just stop sweating, Stanley boy." And he'd gone to one of the London pipe makers and said his chum was out in Burma and he didn't like smoking cigars. And they sent me two, it was Peterson pipes. I had two lovely pipes sent all the way from London. And they arrived, funny enough. This one of these strange things happened. So all we did then was I used to crumble up a Burma sugar and stick it in my pipe and had a couple of pipes to smoke one throughout the campaign.
Was there any organisation like NAFI or supplies of that nature coming through?
Well, there were bits and pieces, obviously, but it was very spasmodic. But there was no. I mean, it was the distance, sheer distance. People don't realise that from the north of Burma down to Rangoon, you're talking about hundreds and hundreds of miles. I mean, there was just no proper organisation where supplies of that nature. It was not possible.
When you talked about the gang sharing your cake, was that your platoon?
No. This was my batman and my sergeant, and my company runner. They were about a little. I mean, it was only like that. It couldn't go very far, but the chosen few had a very pleasant evening over a cup of char and a piece of cake.
What are your recollections of your men that fought with you?
Well, overall, I think they were tremendous. I don't think there was a bad one. Some were better than others, obviously, but overall, no, they were great lads. There was the odd mourner and there was a odd skiver, a typical cross-section, but by and large, they were first class. There was no question about that.
Does any stand out in your memory particularly?
No. But funny enough, what I do remember, if you recollect, when we cut the road and rail south of Mandalay, that was the last casualty death. And it was one of the nicest lads I had. It was a lad called Corporal Biff Wilson from Derby. And obviously that was a very difficult letter to write home to his parents because at that time, obviously, I didn't know it would be the last casualty would suffer. But he was very unlucky. He was the last one.
How was he killed?
We heard the people coming down the road, as I told you, and obviously there were some shots exchanged before we got them, and he was unfortunate to catch one of the field bullets that was flying around, and a very severe stomach wound, and he died before we could get him anywhere.
And it was one of your duties to write to his parents. Mm-hmm. What do you say?
You might well ask. It's the most difficult thing. You try to keep it brief because you wouldn't feel it'd be sincere. You write a lot. But he was, I mean, I can say this, he was a grand lad, was Biff Wilson. And it was one of the clearest recollections. There was also a very cheerful Tyneside laddie called Sid Bennett, who was a typical Geordie, little wiry lad, and had the good fortune to, quite accidentally, bump into him virtually, because on my way to work in Darlington one morning there was a big Holtz removal van driving up and this huge thing screamed to a stop and somebody leapt out shouting, Mr. Wood, it's me, it's Sid again. And it was Corporal Bennett so for God's sake shift it, removal van, otherwise the police would be after him. It was still ticking over in the middle of the road, so he pulled in, we had a 10-minute chat and funny enough I did hear from him after that, and then when I got in touch, he'd moved, and I wasn't able to pursue the contact again. But he was a wonderful Tyneside character, and he was one of the few that I actually did meet afterwards.
Did you lose many men yourself?
No, the casualties were, I say, very few and far between. I think Yeah, the wounded, yes, but I think the actual death casualties were very minimal throughout the regiment in this push down. It was mostly the pitch battle of Kamhema and the early days of breaking out from there where the numbers, they were minimal after that, relatively speaking, anyhow.
Did you have any particular narrow escapes yourself?
No, I've been next to people who've been shot, yes. Well, the person next to you, you know, been wounded, yes, on either side.
What recollections have you of your NCOs?
By and large, they were very liable. A good bunch of lads altogether. Fortunately, they were lads with experience, which I lent on initially when I, you know, first went into Burma.
Were they good leaders at their level?
Yes, I think they were. Yeah, they were. I had one sergeant particularly good who, you got the feeling that whatever decision the lad is, felt this, you know, man, he knows what we're doing. So he got the support. He was a very good lad.
Do you recall his name?
No, I'm afraid not that one.
Are there any particular stories of characters within your unit? You've mentioned the Geordie lad, but you know, obviously in a fighting and dangerous situation that you were in, you would get your comedian, if you may say.
Well, there was always somebody capable of lifting your spirits, making some odd remark that nobody at this stage would, you know, long range can give you in detail both names and that. A lot of them escape me now after this long period of time.
But the basic response between other ranks and NCOs within your own small unit was a good one.
Well, yes, I think it was because of the peculiar situation that you needed to be supportive of each other. Because, you know, even as a platoon, you didn't see much of the other company platoons and people because you were in this environment where you were separated. You weren't ever all congregated together, except when you were pulled out, rarely, for a rest period. And even then you had your own company compounds where you were just getting, having a good wash and getting new gear on and whatever, and having sores and things attended to. No, it...
Who was your company commander, do you recall?
No, I can't remember that one because we kept changing round quite a bit.
Any other officers in the company that you came in contact with?
Well, I say there was Captain Greenwell, Conky Greenwell. He made a name for himself when he was in the Alicante. He used to go into action blowing his hunting horn. And the colonel was known as Tank Waterhouse, of course. He was built like a tank, was Tank Waterhouse. And I remember the adjutant fella, but that escapes me as well.
Did you have many new men coming into your unit during the course of your period of time that you were there?
No, not after. We were about, I should think, the last reinforcements that came in at about the period I did. So, no, I don't think we had many coming in after that period of time when I arrived. But A, we weren't having the casualties. And possibly this is the answer. I mean, we must have been up to strength, otherwise they would have sent. But certainly there were very few arrived, if any, that I can recollect, the newcomers after I arrived. I remember one officer coming only, and he was unfortunate because within 24 hours, he was killed by a sniper.
Was the influence of the higher command felt down to your level of a unit? I'm thinking in terms of, did the men have any opinion of Slim, for example?
Typical, I mean, he was known as Old Bill, you know, Bill Slim, but... No, really. Even Lord Louis, who did actually come and give us a pep talk, was roundly booed in a cheerful sort of way. But when he was asking, I think it was one occasion where you're not going into reserve, I'm going to ask you to once more. And basically, what it was that you couldn't put two Indian or African battalions in together. There always had to be a British or whatever supporting troop. So we were virtually doing two stints to their one, whatever activity was taking place. And I remember on this occasion, you know, once more I'm going to ask you to do this. And he was roundly booed and cheered, and he saluted and laughed.
And where was this?
This was in Burma. This was just prior to us being pulled out, you know, to we flew out from across to Chittagong and go back and do the.
You mentioned Indian troops. Did you have much contact with them?
No.
Were they respected at all in general terms?
There were some good ones, but there was West African troops as well. But
and what was the opinion of West African troops?
Well, not particularly helpful to have alongside you.
You found this out, did you?
Mm.
Were there any other, what shall we say, foreign troops that were close to you?
No.
Did you come into contact with the Americans in other than your party?
No, not really. Because they were in northern Burma, they were building the Burma Road, and as I say, we didn't see many, if any, except the people we met on this air base at Tadoura and Ramri.
Did you ever come across released British prisoners?
No, we picked up one or two Chindits. When we got down as far as Rangoon and that, they were coming out of the jungle, and these poor lads. Well, I thought we looked rough, but by God, they'd suffered. They were in a terrible state.
And they'd been locked in the jungle
away from. But they survived.
The news that the atomic bomb had been dropped would be, how was that greeted?
Three hearty cheers. Because no fighting had been going on, if you recollect, from May onwards, and we're going up to Christmas 45, and we're still out there with the prospect of further action, pushing down the isthmus to relieve Singapore. So no, it gave nothing but joy and hope to all the lads out there.
You went back to India. It didn't just stop there. You were got into certain positions and responsibilities in India.
Well, initially we got back to Calcutta, where we're in a sort of transit camp, and there were mostly officers in the hotel where we were, and the Manchester Regiment, who were a machine gun regiment with us in the jungle, a parade had been organised in Hyderabad, which had been under military control, and they were going to hand back the state to the care of the Nizam, and the Manchester Regiment and some others were going down there, so we, it so happened, tagged along with them, because we had no real commitment, so we were able, because the major with had movement orders, we moved on down to, I spent 48 hours there, and then we moved ourselves on to Bombay, the transit camp, and virtually clocked on there, but told that we weren't due out for so many weeks, and will be notified. In the meantime, you will assist with the running of the transit camp. That's troops coming in, troops going out. So there was a, you know, canteen facility, sports facilities, whatever. So we helped run the transit camp at Kalyan, and at weekends we. I met an interesting lad there. We'd been a tea planter, Malcolm Ross, and he, another lad. We had some friends in Bombay, so we used to go into Bombay the weekend and stay at this flat, so we were beginning to become humanised again, and would go to the races and have a swim, and then come back to work in the transit camp Monday to Friday again. So this was a relatively pleasant and recuperation period before going back home.
Were there any problems in the transit camp, particularly, say, with troops coming out of after a lot of fighting and obviously being probably worn down in morale, or troops having to be sent somewhere where they didn't want to go?
No. No, I mean, this was, the war was over then, you see. So, no, I mean, no problems, because there was adequate supplies. I mean, there was NAFI centres and games, there was beer and skittles, you know, everything was organised. Completely changed.
Was there any sign at this stage, at the end of the war, that the Indians were restless?
Well, there was signs as we passed through. As I say, the certain battalions were tied down in India. It's internal security battalions. Throughout the war, and it was known, and I found out later, there were 50,000 Indian National Army troops actually fought with the Japanese throughout the campaign.
And how did the British soldier feel about that?
Not very happy, I can tell you.
Did you ever come across any of these people after the fighting?
Well, yes, when I took charge of this jail in Rangoon.
How did that come about?
Well, until the civil authority could take charge of all the facilities, and particularly the jail, I mean, the Japs had been in control, So there were no officials or people. So various units took the turn of tour of duty, and I was given a tour of duty. And it turned out that halfway through my tour of duty, a civil body had been appointed to take charge of the... So I spent a week, or a second week of my fortnight tour of duty, as sort of acting military commander, assisting the military, civil people to take over. And at that time, and it was a huge prison complex where the barracks read it like the spokes of a wheel, and there was an outer wall with gun towers.
Where was this again?
In Rangoon. And it was Incin, I-N-S-E-I-N, Incin jail. And in that jail at that time, there were 3,000 INA prisoners. And we had 24 Japs in solitary confinement who had picked up, you know, left behind and whatever. And whilst the civil people took over then, I was then acting military. So I had to witness all the activities and join in with the reorganisation and witness the punishments meted out, which included flogging and shooting of certain people, and there were actual jail breaks. So it was quite an eye-opener at the time to...
So did you have any powers in this, or were you just merely witnessing what the authority was doing?
I was there till they could take it all over. This was the initial force. We were there to provide the backup, because they had no armed people, and we just stayed there till they got fully organised. And as I say, the acting military people there, we had to witness whatever punishments and what activities were taking place.
But you didn't mete out the punishments or give the sentences?
No. The civil people took over completely. We were purely there in a security, as a security battalion, really.
And was that particularly pleasant?
No, it was not.
Are there any particular memories that you have of that time?
I'd never seen people flogged before. I didn't mind seeing people shot, because we'd lost the look of our honour. These were people who'd obviously betrayed their own people, and they were merely put up against the post and tried and blindfolded and shot. But the people were flogged for a variety of things, but nothing that would compare with the what we've been going through, so it didn't worry me unduly.
In a flogging situation, was the whole prison brought out to watch it?
No. Just the officials.
And you say some men were shot. You didn't have to provide the shooting party?
No.
Who did that?
The Burmese people had their own people. We just had to bear witness that it had been carried out properly.
So that you basically had no opinions as to what was right or wrong? Or
didn't interest us, quite frankly. You know, we'd had enough. They've got to seek their own salvation. We were there as a security battalion to stop any other insurgency happening until they could get the rule of law operating in Rangoon.
You say security battalion. Who were the soldiers that were with?
It was our regiment provided a platoon or whatever it was required.
The 2nd Battalion?
Yeah.
What were the conditions like under which they were kept, the prisoners?
Well, it was a typical, jail. I'd never seen a jail before, so it's rather difficult. There were big jail blocks, I say, ready like spokes of a wheel, wooden beds and, you know, metal bars and sort of exercise grounds. And the solitary confinement block was just a massive block on its own with separate cells. And, you know, no real good facilities. It was very harsh, just...
You said that some men escaped. Were you involved in recapturing them?
No. They had their own people, but patrols going around the outside were doing. Attempted escape, shall I put it this way.
Were these Burmese civilians or Burmese soldiers or police or what?
They were Burmese civilians, and they were then appointing their own people. But the problem was then finding people who had not been, you know, consorting with the Japanese virtually, but it was left to them to start reinstating law and order, and obviously there were people there who had not and had suffered under the Japs, so they were very quickly got organised. But as I say, that fortunately only lasted overall in a fortnight, 1 week on my own to Lake Inn, and then the second week, and then I moved out.
The week that you were on your own, what was your role then?
Just acting military, whatever in charge of, you know.
Just keeping them in?
In support. Because, no, well, they're always fastened up behind the cells and that. And then they had their own warders and everything else. We were just purely there supervising the changeover virtually till they felt capable of continuing the service on their own.
About what time was this?
And this activity in Rangoon concerning the jail was at the end of 45 before we eventually moved out altogether when the regiment was splitting up into units A to reform in India and some were going on the Jap occupation force.
And then you went back to India and ultimately into these transit camps?
Into the transit camp, yes.
How long were you in Bombay before you made your next move?
Well, virtually you had a number given which coincided with a certain date, and so you assisted in the running of the camp where you were, and then when the number came up virtually, we were then put on board another boat, this one with the Reina del Pacifico, which sailed from Bombay early 46, probably January, sometime in January, and it went up probably through the Red Sea, and was while we were going through the Suez Canal, I went down again with fever and heaven knows what, and I was in the sick bay when I landed at Liverpool in February, and I was taken into the hospital there. I had a month.
What were you suffering from?
Well, throat infections and fever and sundry other things that, you know, had manifested themselves again. So I think they removed tonsils and other throat things, and I spent about 3 or 4 weeks in there. They decided I was fit and able to return, and then I went from there up to Sedgefield, which is the nearest demob centre, which is fairly handy to, obviously, to Dartmoor, Willington, where I was born. And I was demobbed there.
Did your parents know that you were back in England?
Yes, well, I ran, obviously, from the hospital, and one of my brothers was then had moved to Southport to live, so it was very handy for him. He'd been a sergeant, PT instructor in the airport, but he'd come out early. So he'd come down from Southport to see me in Liverpool, Walton Hospital, at that, you know, whilst I was in there.
What is the system of demobbing an officer?
Well, virtually, it's no different being anybody who demobbed. You went to this demob centre, and there you fill all the forms in, handing in your revolver and your equipment and all the details. I have actually got an extensive collection here, which I might be able to look at and explain in more detail, but virtually there was a demob book, and you sign in all these areas, and then you walk down a line where there's suits, shirts, you know, shoes, ties, hat, mac. It shows what you want, and they're not particularly elegant. So, but that was a free issue, and you were also paid out a gratuity according to what service you put in the war years.
Do you recall your gratuity?
Yes, I've got it here somewhere. I think for the And at Sedgefield, having handed in all my equipment and signed the necessary release documents, I'd chosen a suit and all it was, I was then given a gratuity in respect of the service, which amounted to 14 months as a private and lance corporal. That gave me a gratuity of £8.08, 64 months at 30 shillings a month as an officer of £96. I'd been given an advance at some stage of £5.12 and 6, which gave me a final gratuity of £98.15 and 6 for 6 years and 7 months of wartime service.
What were your campaign medals at the end of this time?
Well, at the time of the demob, there was no medal issue in respect of the service, and I had received no paperwork or documents inviting me to claim these. So the years went by, and I thought, well, if they can't bother to... And it was only because, under the insistence of my family, well, you know, it's about time you had some evidence of your wartime service medals, and I went into the recruiting centre in Darlington, actually, and found where the centre was, and I was surprised when I applied to this place. They apologised and all this sort of thing, and took the details of mine, and just as a point of interest, they were still receiving claims for First War medals. At the time I'd claimed mine, people who would never claim them would never automatically got them. Some people automatically got them when they were demobbed, possibly because of being out overseas and coming back at a estate into the UK 6 or 7 months after the European war settled, may have some reason to it, but I was astounded to learn that they were still receiving claims. The numbers were quite remarkable in respect to the First World War.
So many people literally had to claim for their campaign medals.
Oh, yes.
They weren't handed over
automatically. That is true. And eventually, after several weeks and filling forms in, they did arrive. And then in respect of my territorial service prior to the war, I was told that I should have been given the territorial decoration. I then wrote back, it was then published in the London Gazette, and eventually the last award I got was the territorial decoration.